All right, we are live. Welcome back to the Jordan Syatt Mini Podcast. We've got Dr. Danielle Bilardo and we've got Dr. Spencer Nadolski. What's going on, you two? How is everything?
We made it. We're here.
All right. All on Zoom. We're here.
So I'll sort of intro the genesis of this episode. Danielle reached out to me. It must have been at least a month and a half ago now, where you were like, hey, let's do a podcast on the weight loss injections. And I was like, that's a great idea. I love it. And then, so at first it was just going to be Danielle and I, and then I saw Spencer comment on whose post about them. I think it was a
Peter Tia.
Peter Tia's post. I saw your comment.
I'm always trolling him. Cause I'm like, nope, that's not correct. Nope. That's not right.
Well, to be fair, I like a lot of what he does and we could talk about it, but I saw that one comment and I was like, oh wow, that does seem like that was cherry picked and inaccurate. And so I want to talk about it. There are things he does that I really like. There are things he does that I'm not a huge fan of, but we can talk all about it. So I'm just going to sort of facilitate and ask the questions. Cause this is you two are the doctors here. So let's actually start with Danielle, because Danielle, you're the one who reached out. Let's start with you. Could you just introduce your thoughts on the weight loss injections, differentiate between them, what you're seeing? Like, can you just like, and maybe talk about why you wanted to discuss them?
Yeah. So thanks so much for having me. So as Jordan mentioned, my name is Danielle Bilardo. I'm a cardiologist. I do a lot of weight loss in my practice as a part of general cardiac prevention. And Spencer, who's here, he'll, I'm sure, intro himself, but Spencer is an obesity physician, and he is very knowledgeable about these medications as well. I've actually learned a ton about these meds from Spencer. So Spencer is a good friend of mine. So such a good team we have here today to discuss this. But the reason why, Jordan, I wanted to do a podcast about this is because nonstop, and I know Spencer will probably agree, we see so much misinformation about these medications on Instagram, on TikTok, online, and it's not the misinformation that you may think. So it's not, misinformation like we're getting more people to use these medications that needed, things like that. It's like people are being shamed for using these medications in a medically appropriate way, which is what is the big confusion. So there's a big confusion in the space for a variety of reasons. We can go through a lot of the myths, but basically these medications, the general class of medications we're talking about, which everyone here listening is probably very familiar with because of the news, are called GLP-1 receptor agonists. And I'll let Spencer go into the details of how they work and things like that. But the basic three that are the most effective in this space are Wegovy and Ozempic, which are the exact same molecule. They're called semaglutide, and Mounjaro, which is called tirzepatide, which is a GLP, GIP receptor antagonist. So the thing is that these medications help with weight loss. Yes, this is true. But as a cardiologist, the reason why they are such a huge part of my practice is because they drastically help to reduce every single cardiovascular risk factor. And wow, heart disease remains to be the number one cause of death for men and women in the United States. Even though heart disease doesn't get as much attention as I think it should, it's the number one cause of death of men and women in the United States. I'd say it's the number one through five cause of death for men and women. You know, everything else is a distant sixth, seventh, eighth. And so every single ASCVD risk factor, hyperlipidemia, hypertension, diabetes risk, all of these risk factors improve with these medications in the correct patient when used appropriately. And therefore, they're a huge part of cardiovascular risk reduction and cardiovascular prevention. And so I think we're here to also clear up the myths about it being just an aesthetic tool, because that's not the case. We've randomized controlled trials demonstrating their safety and efficacy. And, you know, prevention, I always say prevention starts now. You know, when I see a patient who's already had two heart attacks, we can still prevent a future heart attack, thank goodness, thanks to a lot of our amazing guideline-directed medical therapy. But guess what? The best time to start prevention is before you have a heart attack. And so these medications help patients that are struggling with weight to also reduce their cardiovascular risk. And so I think that that's the big point that I want to get across, is that this is not just about aesthetics. It's really about health, and it's really about using it in the right patient. But Spencer will go into more detail, I'm sure, about the meds.
I love that. That's an amazing introduction. Thank you. So now, Spencer, How about you give us your intro here? I feel like got so much power as the host, hosting these two high-powered, intelligent doctors. All right, Spencer, you dive in now.
We have the sexy, sexy moderator here.
I feel like the string bean weak one here. You guys are both jacked, and here I am with like my 111 pound, like soaking wet, no muscles.
Pure muscle, 111 pounds.
God, I feel like I should have pumped some weights before this session. Okay, go.
So the idea comes first, we got to talk about the idea of like obesity as a disease. It's thought of as just an issue of like willpower and purely vanity and just excess fat that's inert. So the concept of like, instead of just even calling these weight loss medicines, we call them like anti-obesity medicines. We have anti-hypertensives. We have anti-diabetes medicines and it has to be taken. People don't take them seriously because obesity is not thought of as a disease. So this paradigm has been shifting over the past few decades. 2013, the AMA declared it a disease, and not everybody's on board with this concept, but this is kind of the paradigm we're going towards. And people may be thinking, how can that be a disease? Well, how is type 2 diabetes a disease? When you start looking at the definitions of what a disease is and all the components of what makes a disease, it pretty much fits everything. Signs and symptoms, increases morbidity, mortality, those types of things. And then the one last thing is that because it's more of a chronic disease, people say, well, you can't catch it. Well, yeah, it's not like herpes or, you know, something like that. It's a non-communicable chronic disease, just like type 2 diabetes, and it's chronic. And the reason I say that and why it's very important is that people would be like, just go on a calorie deficit. True. A calorie deficit is what will treat that excess adiposity. If you get in a calorie deficit and get to a point where you start losing that adiposity, true. The problem is the body fights back in this kind of disease type of state. So I always equate it to type 2 diabetes. Not everybody can put their type 2 diabetes into remission. Some people can, but even still, we say it's remission. It's not, I wouldn't say it's cured. And Danielle's, Dr. Bellotto's nodding her head because, you know, one of her besties is our friend, Dr. Guess, and she talks about all of this type of stuff, the disease pathophysiology. Obesity kind of follows the same pathway where it's chronic and it's always kind of there. Even if you use diet and exercise, they have to maintain that diet and exercise in order to keep that fat mass and adipose from coming back on. So then if we look at the data of how well people use lifestyle to lose weight and keep it off, this is where you'll see my post. And man, they don't do well in the fitness professional world. That people get really mad. But if you just look at the data, like I have patients that have used diet, and Danielle's had this too. She's a big proponent of a whole food plant-based types of diets. And she's seen this in her clinic. I've seen it in my clinic. Jordan, you've seen this as well. We have friends and clients and patients who have lost 100 to 200 pounds and have kept it off using like calorie tracking or dietary patterns. Hey, I like to make fun of keto, but there are people that have done it with keto. But I would say most of these people that have lost a substantial amount of weight, I would say, you know, in that 10 to 20 or 30% or more amount of their total body weight, which would be like, if you're 300 pounds, we're talking about 10% would be 30 pounds or more. So if we're talking, you know, 30, 60, 90 pounds for that person who is 300 pounds, losing it and keeping it off over 5 years, it's actually the people that use lifestyle, they're in the minority if they're able to do those types of things. So the people that we see, selection bias, where we see people commenting, well, I did it. I'm like, that's awesome that you did it. And I'm not saying there are people that can't, like nobody, there's people that can't do it. No, there are people that will be able to do it. I'm just saying for the majority of people, they won't be able to do it. And then it comes to why? Well, they don't have willpower. They're not disciplined enough. Well, you know, the paradigm shifting to where it's a disease because there's strong biological drivers that are pushing back. So I'm just setting the stage for that, because then when we think about, okay, then how do we fix that? Well, some people would say we got to fix what they eat. Well, of course we have to fix what people eat. How are we going to do that? Well, you'd really have to change our current environment and legislative type of things where it's like, hey, can we basically rip all the fast foods down? And you basically get delivered vegetables, you know what I mean? Like to your door, and that's all you can eat. That's not going to happen. So we got to find biological drivers to help. And I will say it is different from preventing obesity versus then treating obesity is different. I will say once you have to treat the obesity, there is this chronic effect from the body trying to fight back. So that's also a confusing point, because even if we changed our environment right now, those people would be very hungry and not happy with us. They would still lose weight, keep it off. But anyway, so this is where this idea of fighting biologically happens. Sorry, this is so long-winded.
No. This is amazing. Keep going.
It's important. So we have there's a really bad history with anti-obesity medicines, or weight loss medicines, as people would call them colloquially. So the people think of fen-phen, right? The 90s. There was a combination of fentramine and fenfluramine. Dr. Danielle knows that the fenfluramine component caused valvulopathy, not a good thing. Then you got to have her go in, and then someone's going to have to go replace that valve. I don't know, Danielle, I don't think you're doing the valve replacements, but I'm sure you've been in with those.
Done the TE for plenty of them, and they're not great. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. So that happened in the 90s. Boom. Bunch of doctors. Everybody's like, oh, weight loss drugs are no bueno. It wasn't till like 2012, where they finally took the fentramine component, which wasn't causing valvulopathies, and they combined it with another drug called topiramate, where it's like this drug doesn't cause so many side effects, but it has like a 10% or so average total body weight loss. That's right where you start seeing those things that Danielle was talking about, the improvements, a lot of improvements in hypertension, glycemia, and you know, the lipids and all that different things. But really, we want to see even more, 10, 15, 20%. So these GLP-1 agonists that we're talking about now, glucagon-like peptide 1, long history. I love the story about them because it's so fascinating to me. I believe it was the 50s where they injected glucose into the veins versus had people drink glucose. And they were like, let's see what happens to insulin. Now, you would think that if you injected glucose straight into the veins, I would think that your insulin would go up faster, higher, and more. Well, they saw that people that drank the glucose, there was more of an effect. And it was like, wait a second, what's going on? So they called it this incretin effect, intestinal secretion of insulin. It wasn't until like the late 80s, early 90s, where they really found these specific incretins that were in there. And there's a few of them. Danielle was talking about tirzepatide actually is a dual incretin, twincretin, they call it GLP and GIP. But so then eventually, of course, big pharma and people figured out how to create agonists that mimicked our own body's GLP-1. And this was for glycemia, for type 2 diabetes patients, by the way, because they wanted to help augment their own insulin production. And the difference is our own GLP-1 is gone within minutes. It's gone. So they found ways to make it to where our body can't break it down as easily. And the first one was called exenatide. You had to inject it twice a day. The next one was liraglutide. It was Victoza once a day. They found with these drugs that people were, their glycemia was great. And they also weren't gaining weight, which is an issue with all the anti-hyperglycemia diabetes medicines from before, because sulfonylureas, which are basically putting a little turbocharger on your pancreas, those cause weight gain and hypoglycemia. Insulin, high doses of insulin can cause weight gain. So now they're finding ways to augment your own pancreas without burning it out, by the way, without making people go hypoglycemic. And then they were helping people lose weight. Newer generations, a decade, you know, the first one came out in 2005. Now we're in 2023. And these newer ones are just ridiculously powerful. And so the liraglutide, the older one, that Victoza one, they tried it in higher doses. It's a once a day injection. That one did get approved for obesity in 2014. However, about 7 or 8% total body weight loss. You don't see as many of those amazing effects that Danielle was talking about for cardiovascular disease prevention. 2017, semaglutide though comes out, Ozempic. Now we're starting to cook with some gas here. That's like, it's a week long. You only have to inject it once a week, not daily. The glycemic benefits are more powerful. You do see with liraglutide, by the way, and with semaglutide, you do see cardiovascular disease event reduction, which may even go beyond their weight loss. They crank up the dose to 2.4. So the Ozempic only went up to 1. Now it goes up to 2, but they crank it up to 2.4. And then they study it in just straight up obesity. And they see a 15% average total body weight loss with, wow, with this drug. Now we're starting to see those, just like the, if you go from that 10% or so from like that Qsymia, the phentermine topiramate, which was pretty good, but a lot of side effects and other things, to like 15, you multiply it by, you know, 1.5. It's like, holy cow, 50% increase in average total body weight loss. And it doesn't interact with other drugs. And who is it? Bob Kushner's in the newspaper. This is a game changer. It like literally, this stuff changes people's lives. Then you get tirzepatide, which is the dual GLP-GIP incretin. That's a 21% average total body weight loss in those without type 2. So all of a sudden you doubled it. Now, and Danielle's seen this, and we'll get into this, but like, what people say when they say they finally on these medicines, they say like, oh my God, I finally feel like what a normal lean person must feel like. They all say the same thing. You can't even make it up. I don't even ask. They just come and tell me it.
That's
anyway,
amazing.
I talked way too long.
Discuss. No, that was great. That was awesome.
Dude, it was amazing. Awesome. It was super helpful. So Danielle, before I say anything, do you have anything you want to add based on what he said?
Yeah, I mean, me and Spencer are totally on the same page about all of this. And that was really well said, Spence. And I love the little history you gave there. It's really useful to round things out. And I think what's an important point that you made is that the big misinformation we see in social media is that we're using diabetes drugs for people without diabetes, which is completely false. This is not true. These medications are, Wegovy is Ozempic, and it was studied in a randomized controlled trial for people without diabetes. Tirzepatide, which is Mounjaro, was studied in a randomized controlled trial for people without diabetes for obesity and overweight. It's not just people characterized as obese that benefit from these medications. People who are overweight also have medical benefits from being on these medications. And I also think for anyone listening, it's really also important, in case you're not familiar with Spencer or myself, I just want to preface also with, Spencer and I are both huge lifestyle shills. Like when it comes to, like when I tell you, the two of us are, I will encourage my patients, my practice, we have registered dietitians, like I encourage my patients to do Mediterranean diet. You know, if they want to do a keto diet, we can help you do a heart healthy keto diet. You want to do a plant-based diet? Like I am all about getting my patients to do resistance training. Jordan, actually, for the record, everyone listening, is the one that convinced me, finally got me into doing strength training, because he said to me, just accept that you hate it and go anyway. And that was the most powerful advice, because now I hate it less. Now I hate it less.
Acceptance-based therapy. Look at that.
Yes, that was amazing. Crazy. Anyway, so Spencer and I are both known on social media as major lifestyle shills. So the fact that we recommend this medication, I personally, I have zero conflicts of interest with medication. I've made a conscious decision to take. You can look it up. You can Google and see how much money.
Up?
So you can actually, because of the Sunshine Act, you can actually Google Sunshine Act at cms.gov. You can see how much money any physician you see in the United States has taken from pharma. And you will see taken.
How did I not know this?
Yeah. And you,
There are some shills.
There are some shills. But you can see I've taken $0 from pharma. And so my recommendation for these medications, I get nothing out of it other than seeing my patients' lives improve and seeing quality of life improve and seeing patients reduce their cardiovascular risk and things like that. So that being said, I just want to say that Spencer and I, it's not like we think that this is a cure-all for everything, just like diet and exercise aren't a cure-all for everything. And so I think that as physicians, what we're trying to get out there is there's many tools in the toolbox, right? Exercise, this pulls one lever. It helps with mental health. It helps with strength and bone density and prevention of multiple diseases. Diet, this helps with other things. This helps with reducing your cardiovascular risk, cancer risk, things like that. These medications, they're another lever. They're another tool in the toolbox. And people just need to be more open-minded. And in the way that I think the entire society, you know, body positivity has a lot of really beautiful things to it. As a woman, I think that it is amazing that we are embracing different body types. We are embracing fat shaming is horrible. Obesity stigma is horrible. But the amount of patients I have who have been shamed for using these life-changing medications to help them improve their quality of life, reduce their risk of heart attack and stroke. The amount of people who have said to them they're quote unquote cheating. We have a new form of shaming now. And I would just, like, last thing I want to say is that Spencer knows this. You know, obesity is complicated. It's a complex, multifactorial disease. There is a large genetic component. It's not all genetics. It's a lot related as well as to environment, changes in environment, food environment, and, you know, epigenetics. There's just various components to it. But as a cardiologist, when I treat a patient with a genetic hyperlipidemia, something like familial hypercholesterolemia, for example, it's a very common cause of high cholesterol. I treat patients as young as in their 20s with this, and it's one in five people. If I told patients with familial hypercholesterolemia who our ACC AHA guidelines recommend immediately to start guideline-directed medical therapy to lower their risk of having a heart attack or stroke, if I told those patients, you know what, just use willpower to get your cholesterol down. Why don't you just will your cholesterol down? Stop eating everything you enjoy. Just will your cholesterol down. I would be considered the most anti-evidence-based, like that would be so shameful. We don't do that. And so the stigma of obesity is that even physicians, honestly, Spencer and I see this all the time, even physicians have this fat bias where they are still stigmatizing this as not a disease and they are not offering patients these medical tools and they're treating it like just will yourself lower. Although some people can will themselves lower, some patients cannot. And the patients who are fighting this biological mechanism that Spencer so eloquently described are patients who benefit from these medications. So we're just trying to have an open conversation about how these medications for the right patient, for the right individual, can be life-saving. No one's forcing anyone to take these medications. They're just an option for patients who really benefit from it.
I love that. So this leads me to a really important question based off of what you just said, Danielle. I'm going to first ask you to Spencer and we'll go from there. I think we all agree that obesity is not as simple as it's a choice, right? Like people say it all the time. It's a choice. You're being lazy, lack of willpower.
Right.
Spencer, can you explain why it's not a choice? Number one, why it's not a choice. Number two is how are people supposed to know if they're the type of person that could shift their lifestyle to actually make these changes or the type of person that is going to struggle with it on a much more severe level? How do we know that?
Yeah, these are great questions.
Great question.
The choice thing, I've had lots of debates with many people about this. I like to bring the analogy of like, it would be like the choice between, you have a choice to go from New York City to Los Angeles. Some people can fly so they can, and they can afford it, whatever. Some people, they have to drive. Some people have to bike and some people have to walk. So technically that person that has to walk, it's a choice. You can walk there. In the same way that someone that has obesity could technically have somebody lock them into a room, like just ridiculous to what extent are you going to go that it's not even in normal life. Mm-hmm. So it's technically that choice. Now, I will say, There is a difference. So developing obesity versus then resolving the obesity or putting it into remission, as some people say, they're different processes. So most people go through life. A lot of people go through life relatively passively and don't even think about it until, you know, maybe they're a teenager and like, oh, I am a little bit bigger. You know, you notice in your teenage years. And then if it were a choice, they would go, I wish I were just like thinner at that point. I just wish if they could just they're not choosing to have that extra excess adiposity. And they may make the conscious choice to try to do something about it. But whether the choice to have that adiposity or not is not necessarily theirs. They can try to do it and they can do things that indirectly change their body composition, the scale or whatever you want to say, but they can't directly make that choice. And people are like, what are you talking about? Like, look, yes. If somebody puts a donut in front of you or an apple and says, which, you know, it's a choice, pick one, but you have to make these decisions all throughout the day. And you're not making the choice to have obesity. It's the body's driving you a little extra here and there, a little bit of here and there, bites and whatever else. So eventually people will then say, so you're saying people have no choice in it all. I'm not saying that at all. I think people have the choice or the agency to make an effort to do it. But I'm to literally have the choice to have obesity or not is not so simple as just yes or no. They can attempt. They have the choice to attempt.
Would you say that for some people, we have the apple donut example, right?
Yeah.
For some people, in the same way, like genetics are, some people are better at math. Some people are better at what decision-making. Some people are better at hand-eye coordination. Like, do you think genetically some people have a greater capacity to make these decisions, like as opposed to other people who it's far more difficult to make that decision that they know will probably be better for them?
That they have that. And then there's also goes beyond that to where there are people that don't have to make that decision.
Totally.
So like
go in on that.
So like me, I'm naturally thin. Like I'm just naturally thin. I try to eat more and gain weight. Even I'm closing. I'm 39 now. It's like, what am I trying to gain weight for? I'm like, what's the point? But like, even I wrestled. I had to like try to force feed myself. But my body's naturally trying to make me thinner. And people are listening to this going, screw that guy. That freaking doctor, male doctor guy. Like, screw that guy. But like, it's the truth. It's like, I can tell my body fights me to gain weight. And there are people walking around with no regard to their lifestyle, nothing. And they're going to remain thin, not by their choice. They're just thin. While other people are going to, they're going to have that just slightly higher appetite signals. And it gets exaggerated within this current environment. So that's what people like. It's the environment. It's like, of course it's the environment, but it's also the genetics really accentuating those differences between people, the intra variability. And then your other question was, how do you know? Well, like, it's really like, I would say for everybody, if I could just click like Thanos and everybody could just get an awesome coach to teach them exactly what to do in a very rigorous, intensive way, then you would at least have attempted to do it in what everybody would say is the proper way. You will know is if like, I'm hungry, I'm tired, I like, I'm just struggling to make this choice. You'll know because, and it's in a, that's basically the way. And also from a genetic standpoint, people that have struggled since childhood, they're the ones that are going to be the toughest. But you see some of them, like Ethan Suplee, he's been struggling forever.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And I love talking to him, and he'll talk about whether obesity is a choice. He's like, I didn't have a choice like before. He's found a way to figure it out, but like, that doesn't make any sense to me. It's really, you could just go listen to some of his podcasts. He found a way without medicines, and I'm so proud of him. He's killing it. But he's fighting every single day. He fights it every single day, he'll describe.
You know, there's something I'm going to add to that about specifically someone like Ethan that I think is, I call it the, and I've never spoken to him personally. I've been blown away by his progress, like really incredible. There's something, even for someone like me, I'll give you an example. I think it's like Ethan and I'm going to put us on a similar path just because we have an audience, right? I grew up in a family, my whole family is overweight and obese, like everybody. And for me, I gain weight, no problem. Like, it's very easy for me to opt for the traditionally unhealthy foods and to gain weight. So it's like, for me, I have to think about it more. It's my body is like, and I think my brain is do the things that make you gain weight much more. But here's the thing that I think is interesting with me and Ethan and maybe all of us here. We have an audience. We've got eyes on us at all times. That's influencing our decisions. Every, like when I don't want to work out or I like want to opt for eating like garbage for an extended period of time, in the back of my head, it's like, I've got eyes on me. In the same way that the Biggest Loser, people go on the Biggest Loser, they're on national or international television, never mind being locked inside and they're like being forced to eat whatever it is they're being fed. It's like, but then you watch what happens once the eyes are off them. Once they're off the show and they regain all of that weight, we can't negate the impact of having eyes on you and how those eyes also impact your business, impact everything that you're doing, or even if your patients are watching you. They're like, in the same way some doctors have a fat bias, patients might have a fat bias against doctors as well, right? If the doctors tend to be overweight. So I do think that is something that should be made aware of, someone might point to Ethan and say, well, but he did it, which is amazing. And listen, I'm the biggest proponent of lifestyle changes. Like, I think it's the most important thing, but I don't think it's either individual, like personal responsibility or environment. I think it's a combination of the two, and it's just not one or the other. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I think when people just think it's not so black and white, it's just, that's the most important part.
Yeah.
And your point about also, like, with regards to environment, I being a huge contributor as well as genetics, and there's just so many components in that you can't really like isolate it out, is that, you know, I have three different clinical scenarios of three different patients that I can think of the top of my head from just this week. I see plenty of patients like this, but just three patients this week that are really going to, when you hear these stories, they're really going to blow your listeners away about how effective these medications are and what we view obesity in general as how complicated it is as a medical disease to treat. Is that, as a cardiologist, I don't obviously just do weight loss. I have patients that are absolutely have a normal BMI. So I have a patient, you know, this week, for example, BMI completely within the normal range, 21, works out all the time, but has, you know, in their 40s, but has triple vessel coronary artery disease from a longstanding history of high cholesterol that went untreated, has a genetic cause also of hypertension, now has renal artery stenosis, multiple things. This patient is not overweight, not obese, and they actually never have had struggled with their weight. They never actually have had to think about what they're eating, and they have to exhibit zero self-control. So when we talk about self-control being a factor of health or self-control being a factor of obesity, I agree with Spencer. Yes, there's agency and things like that in this, but it doesn't mean I have plenty of patients who do not have to exhibit self-control for what they are eating every day. They literally don't even have to think about it, but they still have cardiovascular disease for a variety of other reasons, right? And so this patient doesn't have to think about dieting. This patient doesn't have to be struggling against different appetite signals every day. And they still have coronary disease for a variety of other reasons, because they actually, there are actually a lot of non-weight related risk factors for cardiovascular disease as well. So that's one end of the spectrum. On the other end of the spectrum, I have another patient, one of the top registered dietitians in California. This patient is brilliant, nutrition scientist, you know, works with just all of these like elite, incredibly, you know, well-known top-notch patients. This patient knows exactly what to eat for the healthiest diet. This patient knows the data better than Spencer and I. This patient knows exactly what to do. And this patient has struggled with obesity their entire adult life. This patient is so disciplined and self-controlled in every area of their life. They have the knowledge about obesity. They have the knowledge about nutrition science. They are just brilliant. And they have still struggled with obesity their entire adult life, and has nothing to do with self-control. It has to do with multiple factors that go into appetite regulation and obesity. This patient has since lost over 60 pounds on Mounjaro.
Wow.
And so, you know, and so this patient's life has changed drastically. And it wasn't a lack of knowledge. It's not a lack of discipline. And it's not a lack of expertise. It was just the fact that there is a neurohormonal component to this that was outside of what this patient could do with just lifestyle interventions on their own. Third example that will blow you away. I have countless, I cannot even tell you, so many patients that are actually elite athletes who are, when I talk about elite athletes, I mean people that are competing at national level in the Ironman, who struggle with being overweight, despite training for Ironman competitions, which for anyone, probably everyone listening to your podcast already knows, but this is biking 100 miles, running a marathon, and swimming 2.1 in open water. I mean, unbelievable event. I have patients that are ultra marathon runners that have always struggled with their weight their entire lives. They actually got into fitness for weight, despite training at this level, have not been able to lose weight and reduce some of their cardiovascular risk factors until they started a GLP-1 medication like Wegovy or Mounjaro. And these are people who are exercising more than any of the three of us combined. And so it's not that they don't know what to eat. It's just that they needed something else to help them regulate their appetite, change the appetite structure, change the way that they're eating, even though they were already eating healthy, but they were just eating maybe, you know, in excess of calories than they needed despite doing all this exercise. You may think, wow, that's impossible. It's actually not impossible. I actually see a lot of patients mm-hmm. like this. And so I think that we're not saying every single person who is overweight or obese needs to go on these medications. Absolutely not. They're going to be inspiring people, of course, who do it on their own. And like Spencer said, that fight it every single day. But we now have medications that exist for patients who want to use them and not feel, should not feel ashamed for using medical therapy the same way we use medical therapy to help with a multitude of other diseases. And the last point I want to make is that when people say, well, you're going to medicate someone for the rest of their life, and we can go through the, you know, the data on this and how long you have to be on it, et cetera, I know Spencer will, we can talk about the step three extension trial, all those things. But when I look at patients who have multiple comorbidities that are using this to help with weight loss, when actually, if in the, you know, in the scenario that they do stay on a GLP-1 medication, oftentimes we're not, and I know Spencer can attest to this for his patients as well, they're actually going to end up trading 3, 4, 5, 6 other medications for this one. Because as their hypertension goes into remission, as their diabetes goes into remission, even if they don't have diabetes, as their high blood pressure goes into remission, many patients with elevated cholesterol, elevated triglycerides, as their metabolic syndrome goes into remission, these patients are able to de-escalate a ridiculous amount of medications and trade it for one. So all of these arguments that this medication's cheating, or that it's like, you know, you're just throwing another medication on top of medications. No, we're actually addressing an underlying biological, very complex disease, very complex multifactorial disease. And it's not about just personal self-control and discipline. My ultra marathon runner patients who have benefited from this medication, my registered dietitian patient who knows the data inside and out, who has benefited from this medication, these patients, what makes them less dedicated to their health than my patient who doesn't have to think about what they're eating every day and walks around with a BMI of 22? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's amazing points. I love all of it. It's super helpful. I think one analogy that I've used, I'd love to hear both your opinions on this, because I think a lot of people don't understand. There are huge differences in terms of how people experience hunger, right? And some people get very, very hungry, whereas others don't really get that hungry. And the analogy that I'll use is, imagine you're the most exhausted you've ever been in your life. Like you've been just, you're absolutely exhausted. Like all you want to do is just go to sleep, and someone else isn't really tired. Like they're not tired at all. Like, and the person who's not really tired is like, just stay awake. It's not that big of a deal. But the person, like, you're exhausted. You've been up for days. Like, and you're just so tired. And they're just like, it's not a big deal. Just stay awake. You're like, I'm fucking exhausted. And that's how I think some people, their hunger levels are very different. And it's not difficult for anyone who has any semblance of logical thinking or reasoning that we're all different in so many different ways. There are a lot of similarities between us, but people experience things differently and for so many different reasons. And so it's, yes, self-control plays a part in it, but for some people, self-control is going to be exponentially more difficult than for someone, like you said, the patient who doesn't really need to think about it. So for the patient who's like, you know, they're not really that tired, staying awake is pretty easy. For the patient who's exhausted, staying awake is much, much more difficult.
It's like Spencer and I both know, you always meet that person in med school that's like, I've never drank caffeine. And you're like, what? How do you get through residency? You go through, you know, days in cardiology fellowship. You meet someone, I'd be like, wow, I've been awake for 4 days in the ICU. And you meet your co-fellow who's like, I never drink caffeine. Oh my God. I'm like, how are you awake? We all just have like different, you know, biological, different life experience, biological mechanisms at play. And you're exactly right.
Yeah, that's a good analogy.
You like that one? All right, cool.
Yeah, I always say like it's like an itch that you just tell them don't scratch it. And it just keeps getting more intense or whatever. But like I like the tired one. That's a good one.
You can use it.
I'm gonna give you credit though.
Call me Doc.
I've seen your little skits. You look like a good doctor.
So I have a bunch more questions. And actually, Danielle, this one is for you. You had mentioned early on that there are cardiovascular benefits to this medication, often separate from weight loss. Can you discuss, maybe I got that wrong, but can you discuss that?
Sure. So it's actually, I don't think we can at this point separate it from the weight loss, because in the clinical, in the randomized controlled trials, it is in the setting of weight loss that we see these benefits happen. But I will say the following is that there are so many, there's a multifactorial process going on, right? So when people use these medications, it's not just that the number on the scale is going down and they're losing more adipose tissue. It changes the way from, we know that GLP-1 receptor agonists change the way patients have satiety, so the weight feeling of fullness, these appetite signaling. And so it actually changes the desire for hyperpalatable foods, maybe highly processed foods, foods that are higher in fat. And so it makes the decision process of eating healthier foods more possible and easier, and taking less of that quote unquote self-control. And the thing is that you can actually be, so hyperlipidemia is one of these risk factors where you can be thin as a rail, a BMI of 19, and have insanely high cholesterol because of what you're eating, right? It's actually a weight neutral thing. You can actually essentially skyrocket your cholesterol in a couple of weeks by downing butter, high saturated fat, low fiber diet. And so these medications aren't a statin. They're not lowering your cholesterol that way. But what they're doing is they're enabling patients to make dietary decisions that are enabling a healthier diet. So the medications are enabling, helping patients to make these lifestyle choices and these dietary decisions that are helping their cardiometabolic health. But the patients are the ones who are doing that work. It's not like doing it for them. The patients are choosing to eat foods that are in a lower quantity and foods that are healthier. And so if you have someone that goes on this medication and they continue eating an entirely butter in their coffee, bulletproof diet, and they do not change their saturated fat content at all, their cholesterol will not improve. But the reason why all the randomized controlled trials show that, every single one of these randomized controlled trials for those three drugs I mentioned show that people's cholesterol improves, is in the setting of weight loss, but also because these patients are clearly making dietary choices that are also helping their hyperlipidemia, as well as their high blood pressure and things like that. So it's kind of a combination of all in itself that helps patients to improve lifestyle.
That makes total sense.
What are your thoughts, Spence, on that?
Yeah. So when you look at the cardiovascular outcome trials for like these GLP-1 agonists, I mean, these are all in type 2 diabetes. We're going to see there's one coming up.
You're right. The cardiovascular outcomes, but the ASCVD risk factor. So even in the patients without diabetes, the ASCVD risk factor.
Oh yeah. They all improve.
They all improve.
I'm talking about the actual trials.
Yeah, totally. So
they're in patients heart attack, with diabetes, stroke. And they don't think it has to do with the glycemic benefit per se. Is it potentially the weight loss, or I don't know. There's some other potential biological plausibility of like something, the GLP-1 receptors on the heart. I don't know.
What does your gut tell you? Like, does your gut tell you it's the weight loss? Like
my gut tells me it's not just the weight loss, but it's partially that it's adiposity based. So as the whole milieu of improving everything that's related to metabolic syndrome, insulin resistance, and adiposity. So I my guess is that that's a big component of it, but then there might be something else about these drugs that actually beyond the weight loss. Hard to know. I don't know. I mean, there's all sorts of papers on this where people kind of debate.
I love it though. There's a lot of power in just saying, I don't know yet. Like, everyone wants to know, but we don't know yet.
The thing is that you can lose weight and not reduce your cardiovascular risk. That's why this is so important. You can lose weight on a high saturated fat keto diet and drastically increase your cardiovascular risk.
Yep.
If you skyrocket your LDL from, I can have a patient whose BMI is 27 who eats a very healthy, low saturated fat Mediterranean style diet, who has an LDL of 90. And if they could lose 20 pounds and go on a high saturated fat, low fiber, keto or carnivore diet and skyrocket their LDL above 300, guess what? Their cardiovascular risk can drastically increase. So that's why what Spencer's saying and why my belief is that it has to do with not just the weight loss per se, but what the patients are doing in that weight loss. Because if you take that same patient on a GLP-1 and they're losing weight, but they go on that high saturated fat diet and skyrocket their LDL, which is an inarguable, we know the research on saturated fat, fiber, and lipids is like nutrition science is rock solid. That's something we have no questions about. And so
unfortunately there's a lot of people out there.
I know.
It's unbelievable.
Despite what all consensus statements are from every single major medical cardiovascular society on earth, but still, you could take a patient, put them on a GLP-1 and put them on a really, high saturated fat, low fiber diet and still skyrocket their cholesterol and potentially raise their cardiovascular risk. So, which is why I think it's that the reason why in the clinical trials is that we see the weight loss affecting even just either the quality of the diet, the quantity of saturated fat they're eating, something is also happening. Like Spencer said, whether or not there's pleiotropic effects of GLP-1s, we don't know yet. But certainly, I think that we definitely have enough data to show that at least in these medications in patients with diabetes, we know that it reduces cardiovascular heart outcomes. So that's cardiovascular events. But in patients without diabetes, which is amazing, it reduces every ASCVD risk factor in every clinical trial it's looked at.
Yeah. Wow. It would be nice to have like I was talking about that other drug, Qsymia, which is phentermine topiramate. They don't have cardiovascular outcome trial data on that. So it would be nice to go like, all right, this is a different mechanism helping people lose weight. But phentermine is a sympathomimetic drug, kind of like an upper type of thing. That may reduce those benefits of losing weight.
It's hard to know. As a cardiologist, we hate phentermine. I'm on the anti-phentermine train.
But you still, with phentermine though, you do see those other cardiovascular risk factors also improve blood pressures. Right. It's hard.
Wow.
Yeah. So you still see blood pressures improve. Some people get higher, but like mostly with weight loss, you see improvement and you see glycemic benefits and these type of things, but it's just not as powerful as these GLP-1 receptor agonists. It's hard to know. I think we're going to keep teasing, and I don't know if you can tease out those effects. Like if you treat the adiposity, you treat the lipids, you get the blood pressure, everything that has to do with having excess adipose tissue, insulin resistance and the inflammation that comes with it. How are you going to tease that out?
Spencer, it's kind of like an SGLT2 inhibitor, right? Like it's one of those things, like we're not even 100% sure on the mechanism, but it reduces risk in every single, renal disease, heart failure, HFrEF. And so it's like, sometimes with some medications, you see at the end of the day, the mechanisms are interesting, but the outcomes are what matters most. Yeah. And the most important thing here is that the outcomes of these medications, and I think above all, even though as cardiologists, I love the cardiovascular risk reduction we see with it, but I know Spencer will totally agree with me. I think the most important thing that we're seeing that's so beautiful is improvement in patients' quality of life.
Yeah.
And that, I think so. Yeah. Some of my TikToks is so stupid. Some of my TikToks, this doctor on TikTok, but some of these things have gone viral because I'm just like, I just throw out there what I'm seeing with my patients. And it just all like, for example, so I'm with this program called Sequence. We just got bought by Weight Watchers. For anybody listening, they're like, oh, I've heard of that program. So I'm the medical director.
Bought, bro. That's
congrats,
awesome.
Yeah. Ben.
Thanks. So I'm the medical director there. I kind of oversee everything. And the one weird thing is like patients may not even lose that much weight, but they're like the food noise, the anxiety, the stress around food. I'm not drinking alcohol anymore. Some people even mention like they're not gambling.
That's insane.
Just weird. I'm shopping sprees.
These mostly, like almost like addictive like behaviors.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
pleasure seeking behaviors. Yeah.
But when you ask them like, so do you not like cookies anymore? No, I still like them, but I just don't feel like I have to have them anymore. Like it's weird.
Insane.
Food noise. They'll discuss this food noise, like the kind of that, you see the cartoons with somebody sitting there, go eat it.
Yeah.
They're like, it's gone. It's gone. They just in the stress around that. And so when I say that, I'm like also things like, other things like IBS or inflammatory bowel disease type symptoms where people are scared because these have GI side effects. So mm-hmm. anybody listening, we don't want to be like, this is just rainbows and candy, you know, whatever. They do. They can have side effects, and mostly GI side effects, nausea, constipation, that type of thing. So people are, you know, we want to be mindful of those things. But people with GI issues, all of a sudden those issues are now resolved. And it,
wow.
and it's not just the weight loss, because some people are maintaining their weight loss and they come off of it and they're like, oh my God, those symptoms are all coming back. Perimenopausal symptoms, all sorts of crazy stuff that I'm just like, this needs to be studied. I can't do it. Like, I'm just seeing
it. Well, and interesting, the alcohol point that Spencer just made, I know he knows this as well, is super fascinating because I see that as well. And you realize, like, you know, alcohol is one of those things when it comes to calorie deficit, I think sometimes patients don't realize it's very low hanging fruit to cut calories on alcohol in general, because you know, alcohol can just, those calories can add up and kind of sneak
so
on
fast.
You.
So
and
fast.
What's interesting is that they're finding so much that individuals, anecdotally, I find in my practice all the time that individuals have less alcohol interest, that there are multiple randomized controlled trials ongoing right now with semaglutide, which is Wegovy and Ozempic, looking at just alcohol use.
Wow.
And reducing alcohol to evaluate not even in obesity.
Yeah.
That's incredible. And not to mention, like, we know alcohol is just not good. So like everything, all the benefits that come from that. And wow. I mean, that's extraordinary. And the other thing that I'm thinking, where my brain always goes towards, like, if anyone who follows me knows, and as I'm sure you two know, for me, my thing is like, I want to try and fit like fitness into your life, not try and make your life revolve around this. And when we talk about quality of life, I think the first image that pops into people's head is they just think about like, well, am I able to run around? Am I able to do these activities of daily living, which are very important? It's super important. But what I think goes overlooked when we're talking about quality of life is like, if you're a mom or a dad and you've got all this food noise going on all the time, it's like, can you actually pay attention and watch your child in their theater performance? Can you actually like go to these parent teacher meetings and like give your kids what they need? Can you actually give your job and have this creative space when you have all of this food noise, in which people who don't have to deal with that, like, it's hard to comprehend. And it's for me, like, we've all worked with a lot of people in different environments, right? And like, I'm not in the medical field. I'm just more like the everyday general population, but I've spoken to thousands of people to know enough that like, there's something going on that my life experience can't relate to that. But just because I can't relate to it doesn't mean I can't empathize and say there's something going on that we need to figure out a different solution for these people.
Yeah. And I mean, you the thing is, you know, the same thing as like, Danielle doesn't have heart disease, but she's good at treating and preventing heart disease. And
yes,
you're not a woman, but you're a gynecologist too, Jordan.
I'm not a guy. Like,
what is going on?
Oh,
Spencer,
you made it like 52 minutes without a creep joke. He had to throw it in there.
Jordan's like nodding his head like, wait, what? I'm not a guy to go.
I thought he was talking about Danielle. I was like, oh, I didn't, Danielle, I didn't know.
No,
you were also a guy to call.
No, cardiologist.
No, but seriously, working with like, yeah, thousands of people, you hear the same stories. And at some point you got to go, all right, like you can't just say they're the crazy ones, I'm right.
Yeah.
Like, no, there's the ones there. You listen to so many people like, oh man, there's something going on here.
But the thing is, for me, it's not the things that they say in their intake form. It's the offhanded comments that they'll say in a conversation that you're like, oh, like, it's not like, because the intake form is always the same. I struggle with my weight. I struggle with sugar cravings, all this stuff. But it's the offhanded comments where it's like, I couldn't concentrate listening to my son because like all I wanted was that brownie. And like, it's so easy for people to be like, oh, well, that's just like a motivation or a self-control. It's like, go back to the exhaustion thing. How difficult is it for you to pay attention when all you want to do is close your eyes and go to sleep? So, I want to ask Spencer, because I believe this was the comment that I saw on Peter Attia's post. Peter Attia said something that definitely got my attention. And then when I saw your comment, I was really glad because it brought me back to reality, where he said to the effect of, these drugs caused an insane loss of lean body mass. And I believe he said like 2/3 lean body mass was lost. Yeah. Something crazy where I like, listen, I'm not a doctor. I'm selfishly doing this podcast so I can learn from both of you. And then your comment to him was like, that's patently false. And you went in. So can you discuss what he said, why he might have said it, and then what's the truth behind it?
Okay. So when we lose, I mean, I'm sure you've talked about this, but when you lose weight, regardless of the method of calorie deficit, we lose some sort of mixture of adipose tissue and muscle and other tissues, but mostly those two. Ideally, it would be mostly adipose tissue, right? And there's usually some percentage thrown in there of how much that should be. They look at DEXA scans, which is not a perfect measure of adiposity, but it gets pretty close. And when you look at lean body mass versus your fat-free mass versus fat mass and these types of things, they can actually do this with all the different types of diet trials, bariatric surgery, and now with these medicines. So in a portion of patients with the step one, which had, you know, a few thousand patients and a couple thousand, just in a small little subset of it, they did these DEXA scans and they found that there was like a 38 or 39% lean body mass loss. That the signal is a little bit higher than what you'd expect. You'd expect this lean body mass loss to be in that 20 to 30%. Now, again, that doesn't mean it's all muscle. It can be fluid.
There
are
other aspects
scans,
of lean body, right?
Like when you look at a DEXA scan, it's not just measuring muscle. It's the glycogen changes, fluid shifts, and all these different
bone
things.
Bone density, all of that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. I actually did it. I actually had Grant Tinsley, if you know who he is, Dr. Grant Tinsley. He's a body composition scientist. I had him on one of my podcasts because I was like, I wanted to learn exactly how these DEXA scans are working. And we went into the details of these specific studies. But then when Peter Attia went on to the Megyn Kelly show, he didn't talk about like that subset population where it's like in the trials, it looks like they lost about 38, 39%. He said that one of his patients lost 2/3 of their lean body mass. They're actually getting fatter, he said, while getting lighter. Said. Now here's the deal. 20 to 30% is usually what you see. There is a slight signal with semaglutide specifically. And I don't know what it is. It doesn't mean it's muscle though. It could just be fluid. It could be the how they did the DEXA scan. When you look at tirzepatide, which is much more powerful, on magnitude of like 33%, because it's 21% total body weight loss average versus like 15, it's powerful. That's where you see like, you know, low to mid 20% lean body. Well, they did the same kind of subset study. So I don't think there's a GLP-1 effect of causing any catabolism. And when he used his one anecdote of 2/3 of their lean body mass loss, I was like, okay, come on. I mean, I'm allowed to say this publicly. You can see it publicly. We have over 24,000 patients, I'll say. That's public information, I believe.
Now it is.
Now it is. No, but like in the acquisition, they have like all these numbers. There's like you can see some of these things that are out there. But and I mean, I've seen thousands of these patients, and not everybody gets a DEXA scan. You know, they do their in-bodies at the gyms and whatever. I've never once actually seen a patient with a DEXA scan get to that, even in the studies, that 38. And you can look at the lean body mass and fat mass loss with the DEXA scan changes. I've never even seen a close to a signal that high. Mm. I had one follower. I'd posted in my stories. I go, has anybody ever, who had DEXAs and who did that? I got hundreds of emails. There was one person, most of them were in the 10% range to 20% range. There was one person that had a 38% loss of lean body mass, but they got stronger. They were stronger. They were squatting more. They were lifting more. So I think if I had to guess, there's some sort of fluid change that makes it look like there's a lean body mass muscle loss, but there's something else going on, I think, because it doesn't make sense that they're stronger, more mobile, more functional, and just overall better, feeling better when they lost that much muscle. It's not possible.
Yeah, so, the only way that I could think that would work, and this is like going to my like strength and conditioning days, is like the neuromuscular adaptations that take place, where I don't know what their training is like, but just like the signaling from the brain to the muscles, like increased rate coding, increased motor for muscle.
They also felt like they had more muscle though too. When they were explaining to me, but that was the only one. But everybody else, even people that don't do resistance training, because you might say, well, all your patients clearly they're protein resistance training shills. But like, no, there were a lot of people like, yeah, I just did it for fun. And I don't really, I walk, you know, I know you love walking. I love walking. I just walked and look, and it was like 15 to 20% lean body mass loss. I think it needs to be studied further, but to fear monger on public, on national TV, to push some weird points. Like why fear mongering this drug, man? Like,
right.
What are you doing? That doesn't, and to say 2/3, like we have trial data to say, well, this drug is about 20 to 25, but this other drug has like a 30 to 39. That's kind of a little bit high and weird, but like, let's just watch, as opposed to just going, hey, these things are causing massive lean mass loss, and this is something to be scared about. It's like, I would just go like, hey, if you're worried, lift weights, eat some more protein.
Exactly.
As Danielle said, we have cardiovascular disease benefit. Like these drugs are just a mess. Like you can go look up my numbers too. I think I made $30 from Novo Nordisk like a couple of years ago from a luncheon or something like that. Like you can look me up. I'm not making money from these drugs. I just think they're just amazing drugs. Like
person. Exactly. And I think that people make it such a binary decision. It's either you just put people on these medications or they do lifestyle. The thing is that I know Spencer is on the exact same page with me, is that for our patients, you know, everything, I love, Jordan, I love your work. I love your podcast. I like co-sign. I am such a stickler with evidence-based medicine, evidence-based nutrition, and I co-sign everything you put out there. You do a great job. You really do. And you do a great job putting out evidence-based, both nutrition and also exercise science, which is great. You even inadvertently, when we did your last podcast, I told you, I was like, you know, your watermelon idea for weight loss, he doesn't even realize, Spencer, that he is literally the methods he uses for, you know, weight loss that he recommends are supported by the broad study, like this high volume, you know, it's phenomenal. And so anyway, so what I'm saying is that it's not like people like Jordan who don't prescribe these medications. Okay, well now we can, you know, ignore all of these other health recommendations. Absolutely not. You know, the health recommendations, your advice to these patients is incredibly valuable because it's synergistic. These medications help people. But just like Spencer just said, we still want patients to do resistance training. We still want patients to get adequate protein. We still want patients to get adequate fiber. You know, we want patients to do all of the health things that you are recommending. But if they require these medications to help them get there, perfect, beautiful, why not? And so it doesn't mean that we throw out all of the lifestyle recs and that we just say, okay, inject this medication for the rest of your life and see ya. No, we still want them doing all of the things you're recommending anyway.
Yeah. That's a really important point. And I think you're right. I think too much in life, whether it's fitness or politics or whatever, it's everyone looks at things binary. It's just binary. Like, it's one or the other. It's like, it's not that simple. It's really not. Now this leads me to my next question, and I'll start with you, Danielle. I want to get both of your opinions on this. Another common thing, and I think Atiyah spoke about this as well, another common issue people have with these drugs without much knowledge is like, oh, well, once you go off, you gain the weight back. Yeah. So Danielle and then Spencer after Danielle, what are you looking at in terms of length on these drugs? Is there a problem with staying on them forever? Do you stay on them forever? Like, what do you think about it?
Great question. Yeah. So I know me and Spencer are both going to, we love this question. We talk about this all the time. So first and foremost is that, you know, whenever I inform patients about anything, whether it's taking a medication or not taking a medication, whether it's doing a specific lifestyle change or not doing a specific lifestyle change, everything has benefits and risks. There is a benefit and risk that you have to discuss with patients. Not taking a medication, shockingly, people hearing this may sound counterintuitive, but not taking a medication has benefits, but also risks, right? So it's not just it's not just taking a medication that has benefits and risks. Not taking a medication, if you have a certain comorbidities and certain risk factors, can also have benefits and risks. So when we're looking at these medications, especially if you're doing this in an appropriate way, which we can discuss also, you know, how inappropriately these medications are recommended through like med spas where people are getting compounded sketchy versions of these medications, things like that. Those are not appropriate ways to obtain these medications. But if you're seeing an evidence-based physician or provider like, you know, Spencer and myself who recommend these medications to the appropriate patients, and you have a adequate risk benefits discussion with the patient, one of the parts of that discussion with patients is when we're discussing these medications to set accurate expectations, the only thing you can do for that patient is say, this is what the randomized controlled trials show, right? Because that patient may or may not be perfectly represented in that randomized control trial. And they may not do exactly what happens in that randomized control trial, the outcomes, but that's the only thing you can present to them. So when it comes to, one of the questions I always get from patients is, well, I need to be on this medication forever. The answer I give them is, we have a step 3 extension trial, which was a randomized control trial where they took people who had successfully lost weight on semaglutide, which is Ozempic and Wegovy, and they randomized people who had lost the weight to staying on the medication for another period of time, about a year, and then or going off the medication for a year. What they found was that people had regained about 3/4 of the weight they had lost, more than they had lost, like the media continuously says, but had regained about 3/4 of the weight they lost. I set that as an expectation for patients because when they say, do I need to be on it forever? I always say to them, I can only present to you what happened in the trial. Whether or not you are going to need to be on this medication long-term is actually an individualized decision and will depend on your preferences, one. It will depend on what they do during being on the medication. And if they do want to be on the medication longer term, because obesity is a chronic disease, that expectation should be there as well, that is okay too. For what we know about these medications, this class of medications, as Spencer mentioned, being out since 2006 and being safe and effective. But do I say that every single person who goes on it has to be on it forever? No, because each individual may choose to go. I know Spencer for sure, and I know I have seen patients that actually go off these medications after some time or go on a lower dose for weight maintenance, and they do just fine, and they actually do a great job. I have patients who they go off the medication and they regain weight, they go back on, they lose it, and they decide to stay on it, and they're doing phenomenal. And I have patients who, once they reach their goal weight, they say, you know what? I feel great. I want to stay on this medication. And they're doing great as well. So I think that the answer is that this is what the randomized controlled trials show us. We have to view obesity as a chronic disease. You have to have the expectation that you could regain 3/4 of the weight based on the trial. But at the end of the day, it's really going to be up to that individual patient. And that's what evidence-based medicine is giving your patients the data that's out there, but tailoring it to their specific preferences. Mm. We have data on things that show us what makes weight maintenance more possible. Resistance training definitely helps people with weight maintenance, exercise, eating, like all of the recommendations that you recommend, Jordan, you know, eating like a high fiber diet, like lean proteins, all these things. That being said, a patient could do all of those things and still require to be on this medication to maintain weight loss, and that's okay too. And we just need to open the door to that being acknowledging that obesity is a chronic disease, and some people may require being on these medications, and that's okay. And I know Spencer has thoughts on this topic as well.
Yeah, what do you think, Spencer?
Yeah, I mean, so the gist I tell people is that go on and expecting that in order to lose weight and keep it off, you're probably going to have to be on the medicine indefinitely, but it's possible that you could come off. I also tell them most people likely will have to stay on, not maybe the max dose, but these newer ones like tirzepatide. Tirzepatide is just so powerful that you get people to the max dose, they lose weight. And some of them I'm weaning off and I have them on a very low, like the lowest dose. Same. And then I even like in spacing, not even every 7 days, but to like every 10, 12 days. And then we can stop. And my biggest thing is, so I'll just plug my program sequence. We monitor chronically closely, because like if that person chooses to come off, it's not like they're, you know, going to their primary care, which I think it's fine if you want to get it from your primary care, that's fine, but you want to monitor your weight. and your appetite and all those different things that go into why these drugs are so good. Because if you start seeing your weight just rapidly increase, you want to start, you will want to go right back on to make sure that you don't lose that, the benefit that you just had. And I do think, I do have patients. I'm watching some patients, they're still off and I'm watching them. It's been months and that's great. Some patients, they come off and they're like, step. Their weight just starts slowly creeping up and they're like, oh, can I go back on a low dose? Yep. And we do this kind of thing where we monitor closely. I think the people that have, here's my hypothesis. I think the people that gained weight more recently in life, whether it be from kids, which you hear all the time, that's the number one reason, or like more recently, like the pandemic, some people got in shape from the pandemic. Some people just, it threw them off. I think those people have the best shot of getting off the medicine because I don't think they have the true disease of obesity that takes a little bit longer this is so hypothetical, but like, I think that's what I'm seeing. The people that have struggled for most of their life or younger, they're the ones that are like, I'm miserable off this medicine. The other people I've noticed are like, this got me back into the habit of staying away from the Starbucks croissant. I don't know, whatever they're saying, even though they knew that they shouldn't be eating this and that, the medicine helped them do that. And now all of a sudden it became a habit as opposed to a biological driver. It's weird. I don't know how to, I don't know how to explain it other than that. And
let me ask you an ignorant question. Let's say you had has there been a trial where people are on one of these medications, they lose weight, and then they go off and then they want to get back on, and then they give one group a placebo and one group the legit medication? Has that happened in a trial yet?
So the trial there's the step four trial is where they had people lose weight and then they randomized one group to a placebo and one group stayed on.
Okay.
And then you start, I don't know if anybody can see this, but the graph goes down and then towards the bottom, one group starts going up and the other group stays down.
Interesting.
And so it's really interesting.
How long were they on in the step four? Like how long had they been on the medication at that point?
I believe it was like 26. I can look it up real quick. So there's another thing. So Kevin Hall just posted something. We were going over the difference because there was a step one extension trial where they just watched what happened to people after the trial. That was like 60 whatever weeks. And then some people stayed on and some people came off. When the people that came off, just off the highest dose, they rapidly gained weight. Something about the step four where they randomized them to the placebo, and I'll put there. Okay. They had a 20 week run in. So that was the thing. They had a 20 week run in. Something about those people that were randomized to placebo, they gained weight more slowly. And my thing is, they're still in these trials, they give lifestyle guidance.
Yes.
So I'm just hoping, I'm going to cross my fingers because I don't know. It could, they talk about this in the discussion part of these studies because it could be that in this, it would, I believe step one was 68 weeks. Yeah. So it could be that they just, you know, they were on it, they stopped it, and
they had better habits.
Now they're not getting lifestyle. Just so the one group gained weight rapidly, they're not getting any more lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
This other group, they're still getting lifestyle, and they think they're on the drug. I don't know.
Placebo effect.
I'm
should have kept giving them lifestyle advice, even though they should have done that. Yeah.
So that was in the step. So that was a step one extension, but the step four, they still did give them lifestyle. Okay. So I'm hoping there are more studies, and we are actually talking about this in our scientific team of how can we do this? Because I'm crossing my fingers that like, I love these drugs, but I also am a shill for lifestyle. I'm hoping that it's not just drugs or nothing. I think there has to be a component of lifestyle that's still very important here. It has to be, I think.
Totally. No, I mean, I think it's, to me, I think it's undoubtedly lifestyle is a huge component of it, because if you know this, Spencer, if someone loses weight on these medications, but they're still eating absolute crap and they're not exercising, they are not going to be healthy, because I know every single one of us can agree that weight is not the only factor, right? There are weight neutral health changes that you can make. Someone can be overweight or obese and they could keep their weight exactly the same, but make lifestyle changes that improve their health. You could have a BMI of 30 and not lose a pound, but still improve your high blood pressure by doing exercise, by walking, by doing resistance training and keep your weight the same. You could still improve your lipids by changing your diet, but not even changing your total calories, but by eating more fiber, less saturated fat, things like that. And so although weight loss is like a huge component of this in general, you know, but there are weight neutral changes as well that matter. So it's got to be the combination of the medication kind of helping patients. I call it leveling the playing field. I think it helps patients just make these changes that are more health promoting, with it being less stressful and less taxing on them. And, you know, I think that the binary idea that lifestyle goes out the window and we're just telling people to inject for the rest of their lives, you know, is not there. And also I think, like Spencer said, there's a lot of research also still to be had in this area. And that's what I tell patients too, you know, like so much, like with regards to maintenance dosing, for example, we do not have trials telling us, oh, people will maintain this much weight loss if they're on the lowest dose. So like a lot of what Spencer said, nothing. And so a lot of what Spencer said is like exactly what I do. You know, a lot of it's trial and error with our patients too. We can only present them the trials that have been done, but we say to patients, what makes you feel best? If a patient says, the truth is these medications aren't going anywhere. So at the end of the day, they're only getting better. So at the end of the day, we want patients to help change their lifestyle, things like that. But these medications are a tool in the toolbox to use as well. And it's not a life sentence necessarily that you have to be on it forever, but if you are going to be on it really long term, that's okay too, because we know that it can help people.
And one thing I'll add on to that, especially in regard to the lifestyle changes, I completely agree with you, Danielle. I think what you were saying, Spencer, is like you were hoping lifestyle changes are like what can help people maintain even if they go off the drug.
Totally.
But what I think, like what you were saying, Danielle, is that like these lifestyle changes, they're not just for weight loss. Even if you stay on these drugs forever, the lifestyle changes are equally important to living a longer, healthier life.
100%.
Yeah.
All of that makes total sense. I'm going to say something before we finish. I want to say something because I've actually never told anyone this and I've always wanted to do this. And so I'm going to tell you two. We're talking about like in these studies, right? In these studies, they give lifestyle advice. I don't know who the fuck is giving the lifestyle advice.
Yeah,
but so, I would love to be that person one day. Is like
you might be.
I think like I do a pretty damn good job of it, and I don't know who
you do
is
an amazing
in there
job. You do
giving
an amazing
the lifestyle
job.
Advice, but like if you two are ever conducting a study or know someone who is, and like, hey, who do we get to give the lifestyle advice? Like, I will do that for free. I will pay to do that. I would gladly do that. So because I think that you know. As you both know, like research is great, but also research can be flawed. And if the lifestyle advice that they're giving isn't necessarily up to date or whatever it is, like count me in. I would love to do it.
There's a researcher right now listening going, "Ooh, free labor."
I mean, Jordan, you have like the most amazing lifestyle advice, but also it's your, the way you deliver it that I think is also so like just really resonates.
Thank you.
Yeah,
I appreciate
you do a
that.
Great job at communicating.
Amazing.
Well, before we sign off, Danielle, you first and Spencer, you next. Please tell everyone where they can find you and get more information from you.
Sure. So you can find me. I'm on Instagram, Twitter. I'm at Danielle Bilardo, MD. My website's DanielleBilardoMD.com. And yeah, happy to help any patients in California. And I really think that I want to thank you, Jordan, for bringing Spencer and I in to talk about a lot of the misinformation in the space of these medications. And for anyone listening, you know, if you feel like you've been fighting against, you know, your own body for a really long time, just know that there's nothing to be ashamed of. Seek help from a physician or medical provider that's going to be empathetic and hear you out. Because at the end of the day, unfortunately, not a lot of physicians in this that are currently practicing know a lot about these medications and may not be able to give you the accurate information. And I know Spencer has access for these medications, you know, all across the U.S. too.
Spencer.
So yeah, you can find me at Dr. Nadolski on Instagram and the tweeters. I'm actually the, tweeters. Dr. Spencer, Dr. Spencer on TikTok.
Do either of you have YouTube? Because I'm thinking I'm gonna put this on my podcast and YouTube.
Okay.
Do you have YouTube?
Dr. Spencer. Oh, I don't have YouTube.
You can link to me.
So this will be on my podcast as well. Like in the podcast. Cool. I was like, man, this is great. And perfect. Like, I'm not the best to look at, but you two both look great. So I might as well have on YouTube so people can like enjoy watching the conversation.
I don't know what kind of comments I can make or not make right now, but let's just say I've seen your happy trail and it makes me happy.
Oh, Lord. He strikes again.
Okay. So seriously, if anybody's like, you know, if you're like, I don't want to go to my PCP, they leave me, whatever. You can go join sequence.com. It's my program that's available in all 50 states where you take a quiz and it'll just let you know if you're even eligible for the medicine. We did this whole thing. And then you get evaluated by one of my clinicians who better be nice to you and better have that empathy and whatever. Otherwise I want to know right away if it's not a good experience, because then I got to make some changes, but should be. And then, you know, we just chronically monitor you on if you're eligible for the medicine. And the other thing that we didn't get into is the whole insurance piece. It is a big deal with that right now. Commercial insurances, it's like 40 to 50% whether they are even covered. That's a whole nother argument and discussion we can have another day. But if you want to be evaluated, join sequence.com.
And one more thing, just selfishly, can you remind me where I can find which physicians are getting paid out by Big Pharma?
Oh,
what is it? CMS open label. Is it open label?
Open
payments. CMS open payments.
CMS open payments. Okay. Yeah. All right. Perfect. Awesome.
You can type in any physician and see, but I do have to plug this because this is important. You can see if any physician has gotten any money from any pharmaceutical companies. You'll see that Spencer and I've gotten zero, right? One thing you cannot
Spencer's
see
got
though,
30 bucks.
What, 30 bucks. 35. One thing you cannot see though, is that there is no equivalent of that for people getting paid out by recommending non-evidence-based CGMs, supplements, athletic greens. So people, there are doctors out there making tons of money prescribing CGMs to everyone. There are doctors making tons of money, which are not evidence-based for people without diabetes. There are people recommending supplements that are total quackery, and there is no equivalent to that. So pharma is not the only problem. There are people shilling for tons of non-evidence-based things. And unfortunately, we don't have a database for that.
That not yet. Hopefully we do soon. I get asked about athletic greens all the time. Like, I don't know how much money these people make for like every sale they get. It's insane. It's really insane. But anyway, thank you both so much. I've taken too much of your time. I appreciate you. Have an amazing, amazing day. And I will talk to you both soon.
See ya.
Bye.